But one of the reasons to give has nothing to do with need. Has nothing to do with need. In Malachi, the third chapter, God basically gives this idea. For the sake of your own soul and the sake of your own worship, you need to give. Even if the elders gathered all the money and burned it in the parking lot each week, you still need to give. And the reason you need to is because it's not about the need, it's about your own heart. You and your own God. Here's what he says in Malachi chapter 3, verse 8. Will a man rob God? Yet you rob me. But you ask, how do we rob you? In tithes and offerings, you're under a curse, the whole nation of you, because you're robbing me. Bring the whole tithe in the storehouse. Maybe, and he goes into this passage. You know, he doesn't mention hurricanes. He doesn't mention fires. He doesn't mention anything. He just mentions, I'm God. And there's a place for liberal and generous and right giving, because I'm your God. That need. Turn, if you would, to 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9. Here's what we're going to do this morning. We're going to go through two chapters, chapter 8 and chapter 9 of 2 Corinthians. I got good news and bad news for you this morning. The good news is we're going to do a Bible study. The bad news is, most of you know that I typically have 3 points in my sermon. You're pretty used to that. Sometimes I'll do two, sometimes four, but 3 points is my normal. This morning, I have 23 points in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. Don't worry, lunch and supper are being ordered in. Not a problem. 23 lessons that I believe God would teach me about my giving. 23 lessons I believe that God would teach you about your giving. And I think you'll agree when you go through this text. We're going to do something that takes a little bit of time, but we're going to read almost all of these two chapters. If nothing else, I want you to say, I heard what God had to say. Now, the churches at Corinth, who Paul has been, we've been studying this series of communications from Paul to this church. When he writes to them, he's talking about an offering that they started a year ago to meet the needs of God's people, and they have been taking a year to work on it, and he's saying it's time to finish strong. And he also recognizes they've gotten a little apathetic in the middle of it, and they've kind of let it slip a little bit. And he's saying, finish strong. He's going to use other churches as even illustrations. He's going to say, God wants you to finish strong, but he's also going to say, I want you to know what the Macedonians did. I want you to know what they did at Forest Park and Orinoco, too, by the way, on this issue, okay? I want you to know other people are being faithful. You need to be faithful. And here's this two chapters. And I know you're jumping in the middle of the context, but it's still, I think it's clear enough. Verse 1, chapter 8. And now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and the extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability. Entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the saints. And they did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will. So we urge Titus, since he had earlier made a beginning, to bring also to completion this act of grace on your part. But just as you excel in everything, in faith and speech and knowledge and complete earnestness and in your love for us, see that you also excel in this grace of giving. I'm not commanding you, but I do want to test the sincerity of your love by comparing it with the earnestness of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. And here's my advice about what is best for you in this matter. Last year, you were the first not only to give, but also have the desire to do so. Now finish the work so that your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion of it according to your means. For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what he does not have. Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you're hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn their plenty will supply what you need. Then there'll be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much. He who gathered little did not have too little. Now, I wished I could read the next couple paragraphs, but for time, I'm not going to. But please read that today as a part of the context again. Chapter 9, verse 1. There's no reason for me to write this to you about this service of the saints, for I know your eagerness to help, and I've been boasting about it to the Macedonians, telling them that since last year you and Achaia were ready to give, and your enthusiasm has stirred most of them to action. But I am sending the brothers in order that our boasting about you in this matter should not prove hollow, but that you may be ready as I said you would be. For if any Macedonian comes with me and finds you unprepared, we, not to say anything about you, would be ashamed at having been so confident. So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to visit you in advance and finish the arrangements for the generous gift you had promised. Then it will be ready as a generous gift, not as one grudgingly given. Remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows generously will also reap generously. Each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. As it is written, He has scattered abroad the gifts to the poor, and His righteousness endures forever. Verse 10. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. You'll be made rich in every way, so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. This service that you perform is not only supplying the needs of God's people, but is also overflowing in many expressions of thanks to God. Because of the service by which you have proved yourselves, men will praise God for the obedience that accompanies your confession of the gospel of Christ and for your generosity in sharing with them and with everyone else. And in their prayers for you, their hearts will go out to you because of the surpassing grace God has given you. Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift. 23 lessons or observations out of 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 that I simply think God would teach me. Here they are. Number one, generous giving does not come out of abundance. Every now and then someone thinks, you know, in my giving, here's the process. God expects me to begin with, Randy, what are your needs? And I want you and Randy, or you and Julie, to meet your needs. And when you've met all your needs, I want you to take what's left over, and I want you to then generously give what's left over to the kingdom. And that's not accurate. If anything, it is entirely backwards. God says, I don't want your leftovers. I want what is at the heart of the matter. I want you to begin with me in this matter of generous giving. In fact, in the Old Testament, whenever God would have the farmers have their harvest, He would say, I want you to do this. You take your first couple of days of the harvest. You don't know how it's going to turn out. You don't know what the result's going to be. But I want you to take the first couple, 3 days of the harvest, and you harvest, and you bring that in. You stop even the harvest and bring it in. It is called the first fruits. God does not intend to have Julie and I give in our giving as the leftover portion. Number two, giving beyond my ability is often biblical. Now, whoa, wait a second. Who would ever say to somebody, give beyond your ability? Quite frankly, as good advice as that sounds, not to give beyond your ability, well, you'd have to think, is that biblical or is that just human wisdom? God, on a consistent basis, seems to say something about this beyond your ability concept. In Mark 12, I think it's also in Luke 21, Jesus sits down outside the temple box where people are giving their offering. And people are giving, and He calls His disciples to them, and He says, I want you to see something. Everybody else here has given other generosity. But see that woman? Two coins, that's all she has. She has given all that she has. Would you not say that giving all that you have, this poor widow, would you not say that's beyond your ability? And Jesus turns to His disciples and says, no, she gets it. She understands it. That's right. Back in the book of the Kings, there's Elijah who's going to the city of Zarephath. And as he goes to the city of Zarephath, a widow comes out. This widow is coming out to get sticks to fix a meal. And he says to her, ma'am, would you fix me a meal? And she said, sir, I'd love to, but a famine's going on, a bad famine. And all I have is a handful of flour and a little bit of oil. And I have a son, and I'm fixing a last meal for my son and I, and we're going to die. And the man of God, with the blessing of God, turns to her and says, okay, why don't you trust me with that? Now, would there be anybody here who would not say, you know, that's kind of beyond your ability to give a handful of flour and oil. That's all you have. And yet in that text, it is obvious that this is the will of God, and the blessing of God flows out of not just giving what is your ability, but beyond your ability. Number three comes out of verse 4. By the way, the first observation came out of verses 1 and 2. The next one out of verse 3. Out of verse 4, giving is a privilege. Every now and then we see giving as something that we ought to do. It's a Christian duty, Christian responsibility, but it's kind of an odious duty. You just kind of like medicine, you need to kind of hold your nose and just kind of grit your teeth and make yourself do what is right. And no doubt about it, giving is sometimes going to be an act of obedience. But the scriptures never really call it an odious duty. It's called a privilege. It's called a privilege. Why is that? When our kids were little, we recognized that we were trying to pass on concepts in a family. And part of the responsibility of a family is you take good care of one another. Part of being the process of a family is you love one another through practical ways that the love gets lived out. And in a family, there are many times there are things that you don't care about, but the people you love and the people who love you, they care about them. So you do things you don't care about at all, but you do it because... And so you give kids chores, and to be some little girl in a family who's half-heartedly dusting somewhere. She could care less whether she's dusting something. And after she rolls her eyes a time or two or whatever, finally in our family, the pattern was, and this was not gimmicky, it's not Tom Sawyer nonsense, it's not some mental gymnastics, it's a truth. We would call time out and say, wait a second, this isn't working. Being in a family has to do with the privilege of helping one another, and you've lost your privilege to help. You can go read a book, you can watch TV, you can go outside and play, you can do whatever you want to do, but you're not allowed to help. Your first thought is, man, I wish I was that kid. The answer is no, you don't. Because the truth hits the human heart when you sit there and you realize, wait a second, there is a joint participation I have. There's a privilege that comes with being a part of this family. And when I see and watch what others are doing, it's a part of their privilege to me. And there is something taught in the human heart. Some of you are struggling in your walk with the Lord because you've never been generous and liberal in your giving, and you've lost the privilege, and you're living outside the family of God in some practical ways because you never understood it in its context. You're like the little kid living their own life on the couch, and it isn't working very well. Liberal, generous giving is a part of the privilege. God has invited me into what He's doing. Number five, giving is an act of grace. Grace is an attribute of God. It's a character of God. The world can do most anything a Christian can do except this. The world can't show grace. Grace is one unique thing that only God, that is unique to the Christian life. And God says, in your giving, you get to participate in my character and you get to do what's unique to the Christian life, this act of grace. That needs a whole bunch more work. Number six comes from verse 7. Giving is a core issue of the Christian life, and I must excel here. When you think about what the items of the Christian life are, you would say, well, over here in the Christian pile, there'd be faith and love and wisdom. And then God takes something secular like money and throws it right in the middle of it and says, I want you to know the same way you excel in faith, excel in love, excel in wisdom, I want you to excel here. Has God nudged the angels in a while and said, have you seen my servant Bob or Jane or Joan or whoever it is? Have you seen how he or she is excelling in this? Number seven comes in verse 8. While the amount I give will not come by command, it is a test of the sincerity of my love. Now, I don't know that any one particular offering on any one particular Sunday or any one particular event will test the sincerity of my love, but the process does. Over a 3-month period, no doubt about it. Over a 6-month period, no doubt about it. Maybe even over a week's period, no doubt about it. My giving will test the sincerity of my love. High school football was a blast. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Wasn't any good at it, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was fun. High school football, though, has a particular odd phenomena, and that is it decreases the IQ of everyone who's wearing shoulder pads by about 200. I mean, immediately you just drop down. I mean, it just because what you get is a lot of banty roosters with a lot of big talk who suddenly, because you've got a helmet on and a face guard and a, you know, mouth gourd you can milk through, and I mean suddenly you're so excited, I'm taking on the world. And I remember sitting around in a locker room and guys would begin to talk in goofy kinds of ways. They're gonna tear somebody's head off out there, we're gonna do this, and you know. We had a handicapped guy who was our equipment manager, or at least helped with it. He's kind of he had a mental retardation. He had a speech impediment. He was a tall guy, big guy. And one of the funniest things that ever happened, he walked by and there was this big talk going on, As he walked by, his name was Jake, walked by in this speech impediment, but you could clearly understand him. He said, "Talk comes cheap," and walked right on by. Well, we've sort of laughed about that. In fact, that became almost a football mantra for us. Talk comes cheap, doesn't it, Jake? Yep. Yep, it does. In a sense, that's what Paul does in this text. He says, don't tell me your love for the Lord. Don't tell me how much you have faith in Him. Don't tell me how anchored you are in the Christian life. I want to test the sincerity of your love. And somehow my giving is a part of how that gets exposed. Number 8 comes in verse 9. My giving needs to somehow be a model of the sacrifice of Christ. He, in the middle of this discussion about giving, says, now I want you to remember, Christ, who possessed everything, emptied himself and took the form of a servant, and Jesus became poor for your sake. Jesus, who ends up washing the feet of disciples, knuckle-headed disciples washing their feet. Jesus, who hugs lepers and pulls them to Him. Jesus, who becomes a servant to the point of the cross. And then He turns and said, now that's your master. You tell me how your giving matches up with a similar kind of thing. My giving somehow must look like that. Number 9 comes out of verses 10 and 11. Planned giving is a process. Giving is not to be a spontaneous thing. Now, sometimes, occasionally it will. Sometimes you'll be sitting there at a restaurant and you'll know the need that somebody has and it comes up and you say, oh man, I only have $8 in my billfold here. But here, take the $8. And it was a spontaneous, quick act. But in general, for the most part, giving is a logical decision that you make, saying, God, this is where my life is. This is who I am. This is how I've been blessed. This is what I anticipate the future to look like. And in light of the future that I think is probably going to come, what it looks like, so what my salary is, this is what I ought to do. Julie and I would tell you that sometimes you have a painful discussion working through how much should we commit and decide to give. And you make a plan over the next year or 2 years or 3 years or whatever it is, 6 months, this is what we're going to do. Sometimes that discussion is painful. But really where the more painful part typically comes is later on when you have to carry out or complete what you committed to or what you started. We didn't know we had to have 2 kids in braces. You didn't have any idea the tires needed replaced in the car. You had no idea this part of the house would have to have that kind of work. And so you're sort of laboring and you're saying, God, this is what we wanted to do, and now I'm finding out it's going to cost me more to be generous like I thought it was. But I'm going to tell you our testimony. Julie could stand here beside me. In 30 years of marriage, we have never, ever regretted. Have never regretted saying, okay, this costs a little more in sacrifice than we first expected. But it has proved to be one of the greatest blessings and joys of our life to be able to say, this is what we're going to do. And it has always proven to be true. God has been so incredibly good to us. Number 10 comes in verse 12. The gift is acceptable according to what we have, not according to what we don't have. This last week, the offering came in for the hurricane. It's a plastic bag that came in. I'm covering up the name on it, but a bag came in. It had dollar bills and bigger bills in it, lots of change. You could tell it was a piggy bank or some kind of can had been emptied. Here's what it said on the, here's the note that was in it. To New Orleans from, and it had a little girl's name. It's got a smiley face with a mustache on it. $204.33. Lemonade stand. Now let me tell you what that means. We cut to the chase. It means that the birthday money she'd gotten through the years. It means the kinds of money that little kids get as things happen just in life. And then the lemonade stand that had been a part of it. And a little girl takes all that and dumps it in a bag. When you ask the question of this, how big a gift is acceptable to God? What level of gift do I have to be acceptable to God? And the answer is, no, that's the wrong approach. It's not the level of the gift. It's acceptable not according to what you don't have. It's acceptable according to what you have. Here's a profound truth you need to understand. You see, my gift doesn't have to be the best gift. It has to be my best gift. And there are some of you who would say about yourself, I'm a light hitter here. I mean, man, I'm at best a singles hitter. There's nothing I have to bring to this ballpark that would make any difference to anybody else. There's no way I could start to match anybody else's power on anything. I couldn't do that. It's irrelevant. Nobody cares. God doesn't care. It doesn't have to be the best. It has to be your best. Number 11, the equality of sacrifice will supply the rest of the body with the plenty they need. God has a divine balance. Whatever the need the body has, He has already provided. What you have will be sufficient to meet their need. He also flips it back around the other direction. And there will come a day that their plenty will meet your need. God is involved in the divine balance. Number 12, how we handle the offering reflects how we honor the Lord. How we handle the offering reflects how we honor the Lord. Every now and then for birthdays, Valentine's, Christmases, I realize that I'm kind of going through the motions a little bit with Julie on just getting a present. I realize I'm kind of just kind of working through the process. Like that year I got her that axe. It just didn't turn out well. It was a bad idea, really. The chainsaw's gone over better, but anyhow. What you realize, and so you start listening, and the reason you listen is you're trying to find what would capture her heart as a gift. What gift could you give that would get closer to having a sense of honest honoring of my wife? And you listen, and it hasn't happened all the time, and I would give the wrong impression, but what you end up doing is you listen, and you go, this works, and this honors. We had first got married, and Julie was so much in the middle of music, and I will never forget buying the piano, our first piano, and buying it for Julie. It was a gift that we will probably always remember. Again, it beat the chainsaw all to pieces. When you say, how do I honor God? God, how could I honor you? And part of His answer is, your liberal generosity will be a portion of that. He also says that how we handle the offering will reflect our own eagerness to help one another. Number 13 comes from verses 24 of chapter 8 through chapter 9, verse 4. The people of God are either encouraged or discouraged by what they see in our giving. My giving affects how others give. There have been times that my own heart has been more callous or more apathetic towards something, but the generosity and kindness of God's people, it has softened my own heart. It has convicted me in ways that I wasn't convicted before. You have changed my life from the inside out by your gift. And I repented and changed. I'm sure there's other times my more apathetic giving has probably caused the apathy to flow around me more. And my lukewarm giving has been basically what we do either raises everybody else's boats around us with the tide, or what we do lowers everybody else's boats around us. It makes a difference what we do. Number 14, a gift can be given generously or grudgingly. Oh man, is that true? I have a sister who's 2 years younger than I am. Her name is Gwen. Gwen is a sweetheart. Gwen, though, had some tough things in her childhood. It wasn't her misbehavior, I promise. I'm not sure to this day she knows how to misbehave. But my mother had this thing that when I mistreated my sister and was mean to her, I had to kiss my sister and tell her I was sorry. That's a painful thing to stand there in front of your sister and have to kiss her in front of God and everybody. And I mean, it's an awful thing to have to do. And I remember just how traumatic that kind of felt back in those days. I remember one time in particular, I'm wearing a Horton Engineering baseball outfit. I must have been 6, could have been 7, but I'm standing there and I've got to kiss this 5-year-old little girl or 4-year-old, whatever she was, and I've got to kiss this 5-year-old girl. And I remember we needed to go to Lamar. It's 8 or 9 miles in town. We needed to go to Lamar because I needed to be at the game at a certain time. And Mom says, we're not leaving until you kiss her. And oh, that was I'm watching that watch and I'm thinking, what's the latest? And I want you to know, of all the tender kisses on the face of the earth, that was not one of them, okay? Of all the sweet, loving kisses that ever occurred on the face of the earth, that was not one. Because what would I do like as some knuckleheaded boy? I'm sure I went up and I gave her a peck on the cheek if I actually touched it. I mean, you know, I got close and said, I'm sorry. And there, is that okay? And I'm sure that joyful spirit just, you know, just really touched their hearts. In a sense, I wonder if that is not how God feels about the kiss you give Him in your own generosity and liberality. Has the offering gone by and God turned to the angels and said they just kissed their sister again? You come down this text, he says the next one. It's it's chapter 9, verse 6, verse 15. It gets scarier here. It says, I'll reap what I sow in my giving. What that basically means is God is not passive. And what I do in my giving will impact and change the future and quality of my life. God is not passive. Now, I want this very, very clear. He will say in this text, if you sow sparingly, you'll reap sparingly. You sow generously, you'll reap generously. What he means by that, I don't think is financial affluence. There'll be people in this room who may never have financial affluence the whole of your life. Now, you'll have a rich, wonderful life, those of you that are faithful to Christ. You'll have a life that has more depth to it, that has more interest to it, that has more impact to it. But some of you will be faithful in your giving, and there will never be some massive inheritance to pass on to somebody else. There is not some kind of slot machine that starts at the offering. And you put the right amount in the offering, and the slot machine suddenly kicks out quarters, and the next thing you know, boy, I'm just rolling in the dough because of how I gave. There are people in this room who I admire. You have been faithful, and somehow, I do not understand it, but in the sovereignty of God, somehow as it's worked, you have met your daily needs. And some days that's been a struggle, but you've been world changers. You've been people who have changed a community and changed a church. You have been absolutely blessed beyond measure. No one will ever regret that you were generous. Because if you sow sparingly, God says the quality of your life will have blessing to it. Julie and I, every now and then, will just tear up when we think about how good God has been in our family. We have been blessed beyond measure. Oh, it doesn't mean we haven't had our hard knocks. It's had the tumors, and it's had the trip to Mayo's, and it's had the stuff. And you start, we've had our bumps and bruises in life too. And yet, God has been so incredibly good to us and our family. I don't know what to put it on, except I will say this. I do know that our family made a commitment when Julie and I got married. We will be generous in our giving. And I stand here after 30 years of marriage, 29.8, and tell you our family has found God faithful on this issue. Number 16, God loves a cheerful giver. Number 17, I love this one. This is so neat. Number 17, God has choreographed what we have so we can give. Do you realize that God has been involved in my past so that when I came to this moment, my past led up to this moment so that I was in a position to be able to do, maybe not great, maybe little, but God has choreographed so that I can be generous and be a giver. Some of you this morning had small children. What you did is you sat out there in the car. And you reached in your billfold and you pulled out dollar bills or quarters or whatever it was you did, and you passed out. You choreographed in the car with your children so that what would take place in their classes and in the offerings later on, there was a sense of laying out what would take place. Everything in my life, God said, has been a part of the choreography of putting me in a position that I could respond and be a part of liberal giving. Number 18, God will supply and multiply what we give. Not only will He supply and choreograph what we give, but God will multiply what we give. In the divine economy, $2 is not $2. In the divine economy, $2 gets multiplied, and when I give it, it's not just the little boy with the 5 loaves and 2 fish that fed 5,000. $2 given honestly, if it's the best gift I can give, God promises to empower it and make good things happen out of it. Number 19, God will always make me rich enough to be generous. I grew up in a family that was poor when we were little. There's just no doubt about it. Now, we didn't know we were poor, really, but we were poor. I can tell you stories of that. But I will tell you this. My parents always even in the days we were poor. My parents always knew we were rich enough to be generous. If you think you're in a position where you can't be generous and liberal in your giving, you are self-deceived. God will always make you rich enough to be generous. Number 20, our giving will lead to greater thanksgiving flowing to God. Number 21, our gifts will cause others to praise God for our obedience to the gospel we profess. Number 22, relationships are strengthened by our gift. Number 23, our ability to give and the result of our giving is part of God's indescribable gift to us. If I ask you what God's indescribable gifts are, you would say, well, the cross and heaven, and you're right, as a right. Forgiveness, absolutely indescribable gift. But one of the things God says is, I invite you under the umbrella of what I'm carrying out, and you get to be a part of the process and the journey. Your liberal generosity. If I look around this room, I'm going to tell you there are significant things happening because some of you, in tasting God's indescribable gift, have been partakers in it. I need to get out of the way. Let me just finish with this. I was always taught it was impolite to look at the offering. When someone besides you putting a gift in, don't peek. My mom used to whack me in the leg when I would look. Don't look. So I still remember that whack, so I still don't look at the offering. I don't count the offering. Other people do. It's not my role. There's some people's job. I don't count the offering. I don't see the offering. I don't look. And even when we're given the offering, I tend to kind of, you know, whistle and look off at the ceiling or something, because I'm still scared of my mom. She may be in her 70s, but I'm still scared of her. The funny thing is, nobody ever whacked Jesus, apparently. Because Jesus went and stood beside the offering box, and Jesus himself looked, and like I told you earlier, he pointed out and said, this one gets it. I'm guessing he still stands by the offering box. My guess is he still is looking at what we do. And in chapters 8 and 9, he said, Randy, there's some things I want you to know about your giving, and this is what I hope to see. Would you stand as we sing?